this second episode of the Methane mini-series, I speak to Professor Orhan Gustafsson from Stockholm University about his team's ongoing collaboration with the Russian research team led by Professor Igor Semelatov investigating the Siberian Arctic. Orhan has published over 80 research papers jointly with his Russian colleagues on their findings in the Russian Arctic over the course of more than a decade. In this episode, he highlights why understanding this region is among one of the most important research areas in climate change today. Despite the complexity of geopolitics that often infects people's thinking in dealing with Russia, the opportunities for scientific collaboration in pursuit of critical knowledge can, in the long run, prove more beneficial than any short-term political aims. Thank you for listening to Shaping the Future. More interviews and podcasts can be found on climateseries.com, gen.cc, and on all major podcast channels and YouTube. There are many more episodes being recorded. In fact, I'm working really hard to turn them all around. Please do subscribe, and all feedback is much appreciated.
Our collaborative international program is overall trying to address one of the grand challenges as we see it in current climate change research. That is, how does the carbon climate feedback processes work, and how large might they be? Because there's a large amount of carbon held up in the Arctic, in terrestrial permafrost, in coastal ice complex deposit permafrost, and in subsea permafrost. Those are on the orders of, 1,000 to 2,000 petagram carbon, billions of tons of carbon. Can be compared to, 5 petagram carbon methane in the atmosphere. We're interested in those systems and how those thawing giants in the global carbon cycle might be reawakened. And when they are that, what happens when they're thawing, degrading, transported, then degraded, and so on. We're using all the great Russian Arctic rivers as natural integrators for release processes in their watersheds. We're using the 7 shelf seas of the Arctic Ocean as receptors in a similar fashion for release processes both from rivers inland and from coastal erosion, where there's lots of carbon, old carbon stored too. And we learn a lot through these decades about these processes. What carbon is remobilized? What carbon is susceptible to be degraded and thus forming greenhouse gases is released? We have found a strong link between two large effects of climate warming that were before that not connected. That is permafrost thawing and ocean acidification. So you have large release of organic matter from thawing permafrost on land to the shelf seas. Here in the Siberian Arctic is the world's largest coastal seas. There the organic matter is degraded to carbon dioxide, which causes severe ocean acidification or extensive scales. We're also interested in the methane that is found to be releasing over extensive scales on these shelf seas from the subsea system. We're interested, of course, in the extent of that, how much counts in a diffusive flux versus a bubble flux, because it makes a big difference, how much might be degraded in the water column before it's released to the atmosphere. And we're interested in what the sources are of that methane in the subsea system. As you know, the subsea system has a very special history because it used to be land during the glacial, the ice age. And then when warming happened, glaciers melted, sea ice was rising, then terrestrial permafrost was flooded, everything that was in it. So the methane that we now see coming up can come from either flooded terrestrial permafrost, which we now call subsea permafrost. It can come from degradation of that peaty organic matter, for instance, when it's thawed out, or it can come from preformed methane in that system, either as preserved as gas pockets or as, depends on pressure and temperature, as hydrates, like sort of frozen methane. Or it can come from a deeper thermogenic pool, natural gas in a sense. So we're trying to understand the source of this methane from the subsea, because it is the key for us to move towards predictions of how these methane fluxes will increase in the future. There is no reason, there's no scientific reason to believe that they will decrease. they will increase, but the question is at what rate will this increase? And to have a chance of predicting that, we need to understand the source of this methane from these different potential pools.
When you started talking, you estimated the carbon pool at hundreds of billions of tons. Is it the subsea permafrost itself that's keeping it locked beneath, or is it more complex than that?
Of course, the methane is also in the subsea permafrost.
Yeah.
And also coming from below. So it's not only to be viewed as a lid of methane pools below, but it also has methane sources in itself, the subsea permafrost. We are still making progress on where that methane comes from, and it comes from all these different pools, but in different proportions. Some time ago, it was believed that there was no methane released here because of the subsea permafrost acting as a lid. That we know is not the case any longer. And what we know too from, I would say, heroic subsea permafrost drilling campaigns, was led by the team of Igor Semiletov and others in 2011 to 2015. The drill from the sea ice in the late spring, down in the subsea permafrost. And they were re-drilling at a number of sites that were drilled by the Soviets 30 years earlier. And with that, could estimate the rate of temperature change and rate of or the positioning of the thaw horizon in the subsea permafrost, a very important Nature Communications paper led by Natalia Sharkova. Or we showed, that was also a co-author of that, that the rate of thawing of subsea permafrost is 10 to 100 times faster than the rate of thawing of land-based permafrost over these past 30 years. Why is that? Well, it's probably because, you know, that it had the same origin, this permafrost. During the glacial time, it was all on land, but then somewhere it was flooded. So it started out at, I don't know, minus 20 degrees Celsius, something like that. What was flooded has since then been warmed up by overlying seawater of temperature of about 0 degrees. It's cold water, right? But it's still much warmer than the annual average temperature in Siberia. So it's been primed through Holocene and been brought to warmer temperature. And that's been fortified in recent times with the anthropogenic warming of the river freshwater that comes out and the seawater itself. So it has reached close to zero and therefore started to thaw, probably in relatively recent time. Because if you think about the rate it is thawing, which is several centimeters per year now. It is 10 centimeters per year, perhaps. And where the thaw horizon now is, which is not so many meters down in the sediment, it must have reached it relatively recently, this tipping point, if you like, starting to thaw. Whereas, you know, land-based permafrost is also thawing and the active layer is deepening a little bit, but we're talking about millimeter or so.
Much slower.
Yeah, much slower. That's why one can understand the concept of subsea permafrost being more the most vulnerable permafrost compartment.
You talked about different sources. So it could be within the subsea permafrost, it could be beneath it, it could be hydrate, it could be a deeper gas. How do you identify what's what? And is there any method for quantifying what's what in your research?
Yeah, yes. There are many different ways we can do that, both with geophysics and geochemistry tools. The tools that we have been relying most heavily on in this recent study that we published in PNAS used the isotopes of both carbon and hydrogen atoms making up the methane molecule. So stable carbon 13 over carbon 12, stable, and stable hydrogen 2 over hydrogen 1, deuterium, and as well as carbon 14 to carbon 12. A natural abundance carbon 14, so the naturally occurring carbon 14 radioactive isotope of carbon. So these three combined then is different depending on the formation mechanism of the methane originally and how long it has been stored in that system. The clock comes from the carbon 14. So taking those three together, we can then separate between recently formed methane and methanogenesis in surficial sediments from organic matter degradation where there's no oxygen, there's methane formed. From methane formed by different mechanisms of biogenic methane in peat, for instance, that was then drowned. versus from thermogenically formed methane or other abiogenic, non-living formation mechanism methane. So what we could do then, relying on this isotope fingerprint, is that we could separate between methane that then came from early dendrogenesis, from subsea permafrost, from hydrates, and from this natural gas at depth.
Once you're able to identify what they are, and I think this is a conversation that goes on that I've had in sort of the public discourse, is that the methane is biogenic, and therefore it's kind of a slow forming and too slow to really create too much climate change. Does this concur with what you're finding?
No, unfortunately. Yeah, that would be if you have, for instance, frozen soil, frozen peat, and so on in subsea permafrost, it's thawing out, and then bacteria can start to actively degrade it, forming methane. And that would be reduced by enzyme kinetics and so on, how slowly you can form the methane. But the signals that we found at the site where we were studying the methane, those releasings, we sampled close to the sediment bottom, or close to the seawater bottom near the sediment surface, so to catch it closer as to where it was released. The signal that we found was, first of all, heavily carbon-14 depleted. There was no carbon-14 left, so it was really, really old. So it was not from this thing that was drowned by Holocene, 10,000 years ago or so. So it was more than 50,000 years old. It could be much, much older. And it also had an isotopic fingerprint that was stable isotopic fingerprint that was consistent with being formed thermogenically under high pressure at greater depth, where these natural gas deposits are believed to be, a few thousand meters depth or so. So having penetrated up probably through various geological features of this system. This is a very, this is a very seismically active region of the Arctic. So there are lots of fault zones and so on. So there are lots of, movement, which can create, even if there is permafrost, can create, conduits for transport, especially with the pressure that's built up when you're forming natural gas through the system. But of course, if the permafrost is thawing, it makes it more penetratable.
So now we're kind of establishing that there's thermogenic methane, and your recent paper talked about this as well. What about the quantities of the thermogenic methane? I mean, what I'm trying to get to is, are we potentially seeing something that could interact with the climate? Because the quantity at the beginning is certainly enough to influence the global balance of methane, which is 5 gigatons.
Yes, I mean, there is the potential risk for influencing. If one considers the, also with large uncertainties, but at least estimates of how much natural gas there is and how much subsea permafrost there is and hydrates there are in the Arctic and so on, there's certainly potential for that. That is much more than the carbonous methane in the atmosphere and carbon dioxide in the global atmosphere. But the current rate of release is such that it's not alarming for drastically changing the atmospheric loadings of carbon dioxide and methane. But we really do not know how this system might increase its release in the future. We know it's releasing now. We're starting to know that at least in some regions, it's the natural gas that is penetrating through subsea permafrost, bubble chimneys in a sense. But the current rate of release, the best estimate is it's several percent of the global methane budget coming from the subsea permafrost system here. So there's no reason for alarm present for that. But knowing that the inventories are quite substantial, and are still not knowing very well how this system functions, we don't know how these releases will increase over coming decades to century. That's what our research is about, to understand that, so we can contribute predictions on that. Can I just add one thing there?
Yes.
Why this sort of, in some sense, really matters for policy. That is, the way we have to think about this interactions of climate change with our nature and the natural carbon cycle is that We're talking about a carbon budget that the world is allowing itself to still release as anthropogenic carbon dioxide emissions before we pass critical thresholds in the Earth system corresponding to 1.5 or 2 degrees. But if these permafrost carbon climate leakages are activated so that there are increasing releases from these systems of natural methane, so to speak, of course, there is the consequence is there is a corresponding decrease in the anthropogenic carbon emissions that we can allow ourselves. So we must even more quickly decrease anthropogenic emissions. This is why these numbers really matters. The urgency might be even bigger, reducing anthropogenic carbon dioxide emissions, methane emissions, black carbon aerosol emissions, and so on, if we are triggering larger releases of greenhouse gases from the carbon cycle.
In your paper, the recent paper on talking about the sources of methane, you discuss a mega seep. Can you talk about what a mega seep is and how many that you've encountered or you might estimate exist? Because just trying to get an overview of what this kind of system you're studying actually looks like.
Yes. What we're discussing is areas where there is, it's the advanced forms of eco-sounders that fishermen use to see, schools of fish. Okay. And with those, you can see bubbles in the water column. So with these techniques, geophysical techniques, we then see large clouds of bubbles rising from the sediment through the water column and up to the surface of the ocean, venting to the atmosphere. When we see that over, stretches, and oftentimes the stretches can be, anywhere from a meter to maybe 400 meters wide when our ship crosses through this. So when it's, I don't know exactly where the cutoff is, and it's very subjective, but, if it's more than 50 meter wide, we might call it a mega seep. Okay. And such in the outer Laptev Sea study region that this paper is concerned with, we probably have discovered 50 or 100 of such there. And there's probably been many hundreds of them discovered elsewhere through the Laptev Sea and the East Siberian Sea region. Starting to get a handle of where they're clustering. We are having hypotheses why they are in some regions and not in other regions. And we should also then be aware of, it's a huge area, ocean areas, which there are too few research vessels out there researching. So our ships, even though the team led by Igor Semeliev and others have been managing to launch expeditions almost annually for the past 15 years, the area that we have covered this ocean, these expeditions, is only 1 or 2% of the area.
Yeah, that's crazy. So in terms of extrapolating that 1 or 2% out across the whole area.
Yeah.
And how does that work?
Can that be done?
Is it giving you an accurate?
It's not. The fact is, though, even though it's a really remote part of the world ocean, thanks to the efforts of this program, except for places like the North Sea or the Baltic Sea, which have much more greater density of expeditions, many parts of the world ocean has about this coverage or even lower. So it is a very remote area, but it's still not, at this point, it's no longer can be put in the bin of being, poorly investigated. There is probably more methane measurements from the Laptev Sea than there are from any other shelf sea in the world ocean. Now, there are more observations, spatial coverage, and number of measurements here than from probably anywhere else. So, and oceanographers, as we are, it's reasonable knowing something about how the ocean functions and so on, that with these transects that we do, not covering 100% of the area, only covering a few percent, that it's possible to extrapolate and interpolate between these. It was done in all fields of oceanography all the time, and it gives reasonable estimates.
Okay.
But you might find surprises, especially with things that are so localized.
Yeah. You've talked about the the conditions, especially from anthropogenic global warming, which are kind of increasing the overall temperature in the atmosphere, and probably in ocean currents from the loss of Arctic sea ice as well, perhaps. But is there a countervailing force that could stabilize the region, or is this trend progressively getting worse, which means the seep sites could get worse? What is your overview on the sort of trend lines that we're seeing?
There are great assessments of different tipping points in the world and linkages between climate change and the Earth system and the global carbon cycle and so on. For instance, Tim Lenton from the UK and many such studies and listing different processes in the system. And, you know, by far the most of these linkages are positive feedbacks, reinforcing, strengthening. There are a few that are negative feedbacks, right? But with respect to the carbon climate linkages in the Arctic, the only negative feedback is the greening of the Arctic. That if it gets warmer, there might be more photosynthesis going on. So more green plants sucking up some carbon dioxide. So that might counterbalance some of the carbon dioxide. For the methane side, I don't know. On land, you can imagine seeing some shifts between, you know, CO2 and methane emissions. If it dries up the land, you can have more CO2 than methane. But most likely it will be a wetter climate. And there will be more methane relative to CO2. Yeah. And for the ocean then, I don't see any ways that nature itself will sort of cap these releases.
We touched earlier on the fact that if we don't understand the system and the sources of methane, then we could be getting our policy wrong in terms of how we respond to the carbon cycle and how, you know, and how it impacts temperature. How much do you think we need to do, and how much do you think that you're on top of this subject in terms of getting the research done at the rate that it should be done? Or are you well resourced, or is it something that you think there should be more people studying the other 98%, or at least another 4% or 2%?
I would love to see, you know, icebreakers of all nations coming to this area and researching this.
Do you think with Russia assuming the presidency of the Arctic Council that could be a good thing for this?
Yes. It's actually, I have actually heard that now when one of their goals with the chairmanship with the Arctic Council is that they would like to promote international collaboration in the Arctic for you know, rescue operations, but also for science. So I think it's a good opportunity. I think the international community should welcome that signal from Russian Federation and test them.
One of the things that I've noticed is that there's almost a willingness not to have the conversation about the methane issue in the Siberian Arctic. And I was just wanting to get your position on that. What are your thoughts on how we should be discussing this and how we should be approaching?
Yeah. Well, you know, the methane concentrations in these huge shelf seas are higher than there are in the wetlands in a much larger area. Start with, and we know something about the composition of the system, so there's a potential risk for that being released. So large uncertainty, the potential large influence. For me, it you know, with the little work that has been done and is ongoing on subsea permafrost, to me would be one of the top priorities for the international research community to address. So a question should be asked, why is it not addressed more, you know? And it might be coming down to practical things. I can't get funding for it. I can't get permit to work in Russia. And therefore, I like to highlight, you know, terrestrial permafrost in Alaska.
Yeah.
You know, so the facts are there. You know, we know the inventories. We know there's extensive release of methane, high concentrations. We have peer-reviewed publications showing that the subsea permafrost is thawing at a much greater rate than terrestrial permafrost. We need to keep studying terrestrial permafrost, no doubt. We contribute into that too. But the subsea permafrost and the methane hydrates is you know, potentially more vulnerable, especially for sudden shifts, and less studied. So there are all good reasons to study them. We didn't talk about hydrates, especially slope hydrates, which is a different story. It's also been highlighted as a potential for you know, being vulnerable in the Arctic, but with few observations.
When you say vulnerable, do you mean a sort of...
vulnerable to destabilization of the hydrate, which means then that it would be released as a gas. There are many papers and assessments that point out, you know, from a Earth system functioning perspective, that there ought to be a lot of slope hydrates in the Arctic. Lot of terrestrial carbon input, for instance. And that it's warming too. So there's a risk for destabilization. The inventories such as a huge USGS report and published a scientific paper, and you know, other assessments, and you know, Russians assessments for their side, which has built on much larger data sets. But there's been very few observations of these slope hydrates. A few spotty ones in the Svalbard area, but normally at greater depth, so it doesn't reach the atmosphere very much. But with this Atlantification that is happening now, with warm Atlantic water increasing its inflow into the Arctic, it's hugging the Siberian Arctic slope at the right seawater depth, 300 meter plus or minus, where the gas hydrate stability zone's upper edge is. There is good reasons to study the stability of Siberian Arctic margin slope hydrates. And we're doing that. We did that in 2020. And we're working up this data. And yes, we found methane releasing over substantial areas at that depth on the slope. And that has not been reported before. And it's not been reported yet by us either. But there are good reasons to study that further.
When you're seeing this stuff, this is more your Friday afternoon sort of question, does it concern you a lot?
When you're on the ship there and doing it, that thought is there too. But you're more, you know, where is my sample bottle?
You're working. Yeah.
You want to make sure you catch it.
Yeah.
You with all means accessible, that you get as much data as possible to characterize this phenomenon and provide real hardcore, you know, quality assured numbers, the extent of this and so on. So your focus, your brain is very much focused on that part, just doing the science as good as possible. I mean, we started this part of the conversation about, you know, why is there not so much talking about the subsea permafrost and the slope hydrates and so on. But it is certainly, there are good reasons to emphasize them in future studies. And I think the Russian chairmanship of the Arctic Council upcoming is a good opportunity for international collaboration around that. And we are definitely trying to seize that opportunity.
Okay.
Get more done, get more information forward.
And Igor mentioned that you do have a number of papers sort of in the pipeline. What are the kinds of things that you're going to be publishing this year in this area? I don't mean the actual results. I just mean the sort of subjects.
Yeah, yeah. No, one is certainly the discovery of methane being released from the Laptev Sea slope, continental slope area. It's a key one nearby. We have just through our long-term collaboration, Massen just published a circumarctic shelf carbon database, carbon in all ocean sediments of the Arctic Ocean. Massive database with 5,000 observations from all our work through the decades in our program, but also that everything is in the literature and in the gray literature, and especially from the long-term carbon laboratory at the Russian Academy of Sciences Institute of Oceanology in Moscow, led by Professor Romankevich, who is a long-term contributor to the global marine carbon cycle perspective. They have their own carbon database they held there, but it's not internationally released. But we have agreed now, of course, we've got to know each other. So we have put all of this together into the cascade, the Circumarctic Shelf Carbon Database, and it's right now published in Earth System Science. data. And then, that will be an open access for everyone in the world to research, to understand the carbon dynamics, what's coming out, you know, how much from land, how much from ocean, different sources, where does it distribute, and so on. So that's, I just mentioning this because that's one thing that's just now coming out. We're going to do application studies of that database to understand the vulnerability of remobilization of carbon around the circumarctic as seen from the ocean eye, in a sense. And it's also, you know, a result of long-term scientific collaboration with Russia.
Okay. And presumably this database is going to be able to the data will be able to populate models and help this whole prediction thing you're talking about, of helping us understand that's fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm very happy. I'm very happy about that because it goes into public space. All the data we have, the cascade, that would be wonderful.
Fantastic.
It's actually part. We sent it to a journal of the European Geosciences Union, the Copernicus journals, SSD.
Yeah.
So that it has actually already, it is published because it's an open, in addition to specific experts peer reviewing it, it's also for the public to review it. I think it is valuable to new things, perspectives that are good to have is that these Arctic carbon climate links, if they are sped up, decreases our freedoms of motion with respect to anthropogenic emissions. Without passing the thresholds.
Yeah.
That's why they're important to study and there's potential for them there. And then I also think science as diplomacy, even in times of world wars and so on, that the science collaborations continue, these are thin threads that exist of communication.
Yeah, absolutely.
In countries. And it helps. So if we build increasing strong science as we do with these programs, you know, it gives them something to talk about.
Well, on that note,
yep.
Have a good weekend. Hope you recover.
Hey, have a good Friday evening. Nice talking to you, Nick. And let me know if there's something more I can do.
Thanks again for listening. If you are interested to help support this series and help expand the discussion around climate topics, then please do consider backing my channel via Patreon. It will help me produce more content and you will also gain access to more expert interviews. It would be great to engage more with audiences too and understand your views on these topics. Thank you.